I'd like now to welcome Jen Peltz. She is Wild Rivers Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians, and we're here to talk about the Rio Grande and Wild Rivers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So, first of all, what is a wild river?
A wild river is a river that flows from its source in the mountains to the sea, unobstructed by dams or levees. It migrates throughout the floodplain. It has dynamic river flows, and it is of its natural state.
Are there any wild rivers in the West?
Not very many. There are a few portions of rivers that are still completely wild. For example, the Gila River in southern New Mexico is one of the last wild rivers, at least in New Mexico. The Rio Grande is no longer a wild river in its purest sense, but I think that the Rio Grande has a lot of qualities of a wild river, so much that we really like to protect them still.
So what is the role of rivers in the lives of the creatures who live not only in but around the rivers, in the habitats and ecosystems around rivers?
The creatures that live in the habitats, I mean, they are uniquely evolved with the specific river system. For example, in the Rio Grande silvery minnow is a small minnow that has evolved with the dynamic flows of the river, and it is its whole reproductive cycle is cued by the high flows in the river, so it spawns in the springtime when the snowmelt runoff comes down the river, and it releases semi-buoyant eggs that are released down the river, and those eggs need kind of backwater habitats in order to develop into full-grown fish. And so over the centuries, these organisms have evolved with the conditions of this wild river. And so as we do certain things like dam the river or take water out of the river in significant volumes, that changes those underlying evolutionary features of the river that which the silvery minnow, the southwestern willow flycatcher, and all of the other organisms that are aquatic-dependent species depend on.
I think it's hard for people to see all these things as being so interdependent. I mean, they're all part of a bigger system. They're not, like, existing on their own, just as we have sort of illusions that we're existing on our own in the cities in which we live, but that's not true either.
Correct. Yeah, everything is really connected. For example, the cottonwood bosque that people in Albuquerque and throughout the Rio Grande Basin, you know, have this beautiful feature of these cottonwoods that have grown up along the river. They're part of this flood system where the cottonwoods need these large periodic flooding events to germinate their seedlings so that they can regenerate. If you notice the cottonwoods that exist now along the Rio Grande, they're all 70 years old because the last flood was like in the 1940s. And so there's no regeneration and no flooding to kind of start that process anew. And so without the cottonwoods and the willows, then the southwestern willow flycatcher doesn't have a place to nest. And without the shade that's created by the cottonwoods and willows, the temperature of the river will be different. And so they're definitely an interconnected web of how these organisms interact with the river.
Talk about some of the issues that we're seeing with the Rio Grande in Colorado and New Mexico with respect to wildlife and endangered species. I mean, you've talked about the silvery minnow, but kind of give us a picture of this river and the human impact on it.
The human impact on the Rio Grande is very severe and has started in the late 1800s. For example, in Colorado, the San Luis Valley started to be developed in the late 1800s, and the San Luis Valley irrigates roughly 650,000 acres of irrigated agriculture. This is significant because the Colorado headwaters provide 65% of the flows for the entire river, and so when you're irrigating that much acreage and the only mechanism to get water across the state line is the Rio Grande River Compact, that compact only works when there's really high flows. So in the lower flow times, the compact obligation to the state line of Colorado and New Mexico is roughly zero. And so if you have 65% of the flows originating in Colorado and those flows don't reach the state line, then you're basically the wildlife and all of the creatures that are dependent on the river in New Mexico don't have a chance because they're starting with less than half the deck. So it's really important to look at the whole ecosystem holistically. You know, there's the concept of think like a watershed, because despite the fact that there is a state line between the headwaters of the Rio Grande and then the rest of the 1,900 miles of river that flows from the headwaters, you know, the river doesn't see this line in the sand that designates this is Colorado's share of the Rio Grande's water and this is New Mexico's share, and neither do the species that live there. So there's important habitat in the headwater streams for trout. There's important habitat for the flycatcher in Colorado as well as in New Mexico. And unless we allocate some water to the river, these species are without place for them to live and survive.
So what are the agencies, the laws, the rules and regulations that are in place to deal with allocating that water, and how are they working?
Well, the system of water law that was developed upon statehood pretty much only was concerned with allocating water out of the river for what they called beneficial uses for agriculture, for cities, and other industrial uses. For example, there was no provision made for keeping water in the river or for having a maximum amount of water that can be taken out of the river. So the problem in the West, and especially the problem on the Rio Grande, is that all of our rivers are very over-allocated, which means that there are more people that want the water than water is available in those rivers and streams.
More water than is available, and that means not even counting leaving some in the river for the river and its creatures.
Exactly.
I mean, we're talking about drying up the river.
Exactly, and that's what has happened, because what happens is someone says they have a water right and they divert that water, and if that makes the stream go dry, unless there's some protection for the river, there's nothing stopping that. And so that's one of the reasons why, for example, the Endangered Species Act is such a powerful tool, is because Congress 40 years ago said, we don't want all of the creatures on our earth to go extinct due to our impacts, and so we need to do things to protect them. And so it set forth this very progressive and very important rule of law that requires federal agencies to consider their impacts to endangered species before those species go extinct. There are also some state rules. For example, in Colorado, there's an in-stream flow provision which allows a certain reach of a river to be adjudicated as an in-stream flow, and so it would have a minimum flow that has to be in the river, which is more of it's kind of a later creation of the law. So all of those water rights are very what we call junior, which means that as long as there's a senior user in the river that has a right to the water can still be removed. And so while they help prevent transferring water from a different one use to another over that reach, they're not an outright protection for that river, and so it's problematic. In New Mexico, there's no law that protects in-stream flows, and so the only way that we can make sure that flows stay in our river is to reform those policies, or use, right now we have the tools, the Endangered Species Act, to try to open the eyes of water managers toward more sustainable water management going forward, especially under the guise of climate change that is going to make even less water available than is already available today.
Yeah, we've got such an odd combination of drought, climate change, and then suddenly unusually heavy rains in New Mexico this summer.
Mm-hmm.
How do all those affect the river?
They're really crucial to the river because, you know, so for example, the estimate is that a third of the flows in the Rio Grande, I think it's 50 years from now, will not be there due to climate change. And if we're already an over-allocated river and we are going to lose a third of the flows, then we need to have a plan now looking forward into the future 50 years so that we can figure out how to best allocate the water that we have available. You know, we have this drought that's going on now, and a lot of people, water managers and and people alike say, you know, well, it's a drought. We can't do anything about the drought. But the reality is that our rivers are very managed. We have reservoirs to store water in. We can plan ahead. We can store water in reservoirs to be able to be reallocated in times of drought for agriculture use, but also for environmental use. And that's one of the solutions that we hope going forward is that we can use our reservoirs instead of using them as a feature that provides environmental and ecological harm, but use those reservoirs so that we can retime water so that in those years like this year where, you know, we had a really dry spring and everyone thought we weren't going to have water, you can have that water in the reservoir. You can know that it's available for providing those minimum stream flows for the environment, for the river as well as for the species that depend upon it.
So it's a kind of interesting challenge that you're facing, which is on the one hand, we have a whole system of water law, which you've described. On the other hand, we have the Endangered Species Act, which says that we need to protect certain species. And in this case, certain species need to be protected by allocating water to them, which runs up against the water law. Mm-hmm. What is Wild Earth Guardians doing with respect to these conflicts?
Well, I mean, we have some litigation that we filed recently, which is a way to hopefully open up political will and provide leverage to get to the solutions that we actually ultimately like to see. You know, we understand that litigation isn't the end all and that we may not get everything we want from bringing litigation, but there is something to be said about leveling the playing field to start the conversation anew and so that water managers will bring something new to the table. For example, one of the largest solutions that we think that would help the river would be to we understanding that the river is already completely allocated, we're not going to find new water, but you can take water that exists in a certain right and reallocate that to a different use. So, for example, a water leasing program or water acquisition program in the Rio Grande Basin would be really important to try to reallocate water from agricultural uses to environmental uses. We have been talking with some farmers in southern Colorado that are actually very interested in doing this, and how that system would work would be those farmers would be compensated for basically instead of using their water right for irrigation, they would leave their water in the river, and then that water would support flows in the river, especially in times of drought. And so if you had a system in place where farmers could come and say, I think this year or for the next 5 years or maybe three of the next 5 years, I would like to donate my water, or not donate, but to provide my water to the river and be compensated for that, then instead of flood irrigating alfalfa in the desert, we're talking about taking, you know, basically rotating the uses so that in those really dry years, instead of irrigating alfalfa, we provide that water to the river. And then maybe the next year, if it's a better year, then that farmer can farm their ground and the river will be okay going forward. So it's a way to basically share the water amongst agriculture and the environment, because agriculture uses roughly 80% of the water in the basin.
There are a lot of questions about agriculture, not that we shouldn't have agriculture because that is how we live, but what kinds of agriculture are most appropriate for certain climate environments and land environments. How are we doing in Colorado and New Mexico? Are we farming the types of crops? Are we using land in a way that is well suited to the place we're at?
I think the farming in Colorado and New Mexico is very very different. In Colorado, you know, they're in the San Luis Valley, at least, they're farming pretty high-value crops. I would say, you know, potatoes and other things. I think that, and even the alfalfa in the San Luis Valley is a little different because they are doing it in a different method. They're not flood irrigating. Typically, they have a more efficient way to irrigate, which has its own problems. But in the Middle Valley, in central New Mexico, and we're basically flood irrigating alfalfa in the desert, and so because alfalfa is a short crop, that you know that you can get several cuttings in one summer, which puts a lot of pressure on the river throughout the summer. And so until we either have that conversation and say, is this really the best means for us to be using our irrigated acreage, then we're going to continue to have this problem. I mean, I'm still shocked, and I've lived in New Mexico since I was a very small child, when I drive down I-25 and see, you know, the big brown mesas and then these very large fields of bright green alfalfa in the middle of August. And I think that that conversation needs to be had for sure.
Is it happening?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, the culture and tradition in New Mexico is that the farmers have done this for centuries and they want to continue to do it. And I respect the farmers' rights to, you know, irrigate their land and to make choices. But at the same time, I think that based on the fact that there are these all these competing demands on our resources, that unless there is a crisis, that conversation won't happen. I think last year we got really close to the conversation because 2013 was a really dry year, and until those summer monsoons in July, I think everyone was willing to have a lot of conversations that no one is willing to have now because there's lots of water in the river, and so we just kick the can down the road and hope that, you know, the whether it's El Nino or whether it's the monsoon or some other source of water will save us in the future, which is unfortunate.
What is the role of activist groups, citizens groups, state agencies, federal agencies in solving these problems, and how do they work together?
There have been a lot of different methods of working together. We've been involved in this for at least 20 years, and prior to our involvement, there weren't any conversations before the species were listed, typically about what the best way to go forward. We feel like our interjection in that conversation changed the conversation a lot. Nobody knew what the Rio Grande Silver Minnow was 15 years ago, and now it's a regular dinner table conversation of many people, whether good or bad. And so, you know, we think that, you know, state water managers need to provide more accountability, at least in New Mexico, with regard to how water is used, and that and make sure that policies reflect the limitations that should be placed on the resource. We also believe that federal water managers, like in our letter that we wrote to the Department of Interior, should be playing a larger role, especially considering their investment in the Middle Rio Grande. The Bureau of Reclamation, as a part of the Middle Rio Grande Project, which is the project that rehabilitated the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District's infrastructure back in the 1930s, they have contributed millions of dollars to making the irrigated agriculture system that you see today. And so we believe that the federal government should have a role in deciding and making sure that that going forward is a sustainable system. And so we feel our role is to kind of push those agencies to make those changes in a more timely fashion so that we can be ahead of the crisis rather than always defending and responding to dry years or issues that raise. Right now we're kind of in the Band-Aid mode rather than a progressive, think ahead, try to, you know, have broad, holistic solutions to these problems.
Who was actually responsible for enforcing the Endangered Species Act?
Well, the Secretary of the Interior can enforce the Endangered Species Act, but one of the beauties of the Endangered Species Act is it has what's called a citizen supervision, which allows any person to enforce the act. And so that provision allows groups like Wild Earth Guardians to bring lawsuits in federal court to enforce the provisions of the act. And that's what Wild Earth Guardians uses typically as a way to create leverage and to start those conversations to try to get policy changes.
Is there anything else that you want to add before we go?
I think the one thing that is definitely important to me is, as a New Mexican, and is to see it as more than just the species and agriculture and all of these different entities. I think that we all need to work holistically, and that means that the environment does not bear the sole burden of our water use going forward. I think that's been the model since it started, and I think that going forward we really need to evaluate, okay, well, we need a share from agriculture, we need a share from our cities, we need to try to conserve in all the ways that we can so that we do have a quality of life in New Mexico and in Colorado and in Texas and in Mexico that reflects the reason why communities flock to the Rio Grande historically to live and to make this our home.
I mean, I think that's really the question, is how to really engage people in conversation where they see that it's in their self-interest. It's not us against the river, but we're really kind of all in this ecosystem together.
I agree, and I think that's just a shift that hasn't yet occurred, and it's because, you know, sometimes everything becomes very polarized, and it's a lot easier to fight against each other than it is to work with each other. And I think that if everyone has an equal seat at the table and those conversations occur, I think that there's a lot of progress that could be made in the basin.
Jen Peltz is the Wild Rivers Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians. There is much more on the web at wildearthguardians.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate it.